All systems nominal. Gate has responded to IFF code. IFF read and accepted. Data transfer complete.
Hello, fellow mech warriors. I'm Adam.
I'm Dan.
And this is a new episode of The Memory Core. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
How's things been?
Oh my god, when was the last time we did one of these?
August.
It was a while. Yeah. We had kind of a hiatus because I actually got sick. I don't remember if I talked about this on our last episode or not.
Oh, yeah. No, I think...
Because I was sick even before that one. Like, this one, it was pretty bad. It was probably the worst strep throat I probably ever had, and it completely tanked my voice. And I just maybe...
Debate whether or not that's better or worse to not have to hear Dan.
Yeah. Yeah, probably for the better. It completely tanked my voice, man. And so we had to wait, and then we had a lot of life stuff, like, getting away, too. But now we're here. And
yeah.
We're doing it from my house, because you said your house is a mess.
It is. So, you know, like, all of us... And I know I'm not alone, right? Like, we're all just busy. It's just... That's life in 2022. You know, the grind. But work's been crazy. House is a mess. So, yeah, Dan was like, let's come over to mine. Let's hang out. And he said, like, wife and kid are gone for the day. Let's do it here. And I was like, sure. I see you're rocking your free Razzle Hog Republic threads.
Yes, I am.
I'm one of the rescues that I work with, Feed the Beasts, a metal-themed cat rescue. So the person who runs it actually does a lot of work at the Forge, the metal venue in downtown Joliet. So shout out to Nikki. She probably won't see this. I don't think she would ever want to see this. But hey, rocking those threads. But getting to the whole point of the Memory Core, anything new on your end within Battletech?
Other than... Not too much. I don't remember if I touched on it last time, but I did finish the Metallics I was working on. Mm-hmm. That was a long time ago, so if I repeated myself there, I'm sorry. I am going to finish up, finally, I am going to start painting the Battlemaster Crusaders that you primed for me. I am going to do that.
Cool.
I've also run into a couple books.
Nice.
At... one of the used bookstores, because for my job, I kind of like drive around everywhere. So like if I go on break or something, I'll stop at like a Half Price Books or like a used bookstore, and I happen to find Rolling Thunder and a couple copies of Battle Technology. Pretty good damn condition.
Yeah, they look honestly. Really nice. They look really nice. I think a lot of these, for the first couple of issues, so a lot of these original covers were actually painted by William Keith, who did a lot of the original novels, particularly the Great Death Trilogy novels. And so it's really cool seeing the stuff that he's done, including, I think this is an old school Battle Droids era Pegasus or Harasser?
Pegasus,
yeah.
That's a Pegasus.
So very cool. That artwork matches what's in MechWarrior First Edition. So cool stuff. I really like the Marauder and the Thunderbolt cover from this one. Really cool stuff. So yeah, they're really fun issues. And it's kind of a shame that... I don't know, I was hoping Shrapnel would be more like this. But Shrapnel's definitely got some good stuff. The quarterly anthology they release. But those original Battle Technology issues are really cool. Really cool.
Battle Technology seems more like... I mean, obviously, it's a magazine. Mm-hmm. That was the whole idea behind it. But, like, a magazine set in the actual setting, so it's kind of like meta.
Yeah.
But Shrapnel is more just your... What do they have, like, back then? Like, you had, like, a science fiction...
Yeah, like an Asimov's.
Yeah.
One of the things about the magazines is that there were a couple of them out by different companies. I can't remember what TSR did for... their stuff, like Dungeons and Dragons. Obviously, there was a White Dwarf for GW, and there were a couple of others.
Dragon Magazine.
Yeah, Dragon. And so a lot of them started out as, this is what's new in the hobby and the industry, and then very quickly they kind of morphed into the term is like house organ, where it was just literally to promote that company's products rather than being an overarching look. And while I understand the desire to support your own products and push your own products as a sort of way to advertise them, especially in an era before the internet, there was something that I thought was more, you know, egalitarian and more welcoming in the community of all these different IPs and companies. Like, hey, cool, you know, we're gonna publish your thing, in our magazine and support, the next door neighbor. Kind of like in the way how a lot of these companies will promote each other's Kickstarters. You'll see that, which is always nice to see. Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool seeing them collaborate together. Dragon Magazine did have a couple BattleTech related articles in it. I think the infamous one would be the one with all the battle mech quirks.
Okay.
I don't remember off the top of my head what issue it was. I mean, I'm a fan, but I'm not like an encyclopedia. But I could probably reference it at the bottom of the video in case any of you are interested. But that was the, I believe, the first place where battle mech quirks actually showed up.
Yeah, yeah. Which, quirks started showing up in some of the various TROs, but the nice one is the big list of quirks in the Battle Mech Manual, which is pretty cool. There's some negative and positive quirks. It'd be cool to play a game with those. We'll kind of circle back to that, in terms of an ongoing campaign kind of thing, where I think they'd be more appropriate than a stand-up fight. But yeah. Yeah. Paint anything good recently?
I started the last thing I tried was the Warhawk, and I just completely stopped. Just stopped.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So I haven't really, it's been kind of a short break from BattleTech for me, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I haven't done too much with it, maybe messed around Mega Mech or something a few times, but
yeah.
That's really it.
Yeah, I mean, I on my end, I've been trying to work my way through the Jihad books, and that's a whole series that I would like to do. I mean, we talk about that a lot, things we would like to do, but of course, life gets in the way, and we don't need to do this for our job, so it's not too important that we get a video out every week. The Jihad books, I think, have been the whole Jihad era has been underrated. I think there's a number of reasons for that, which is a whole episode on its own. What was happening in the games industry at the time, what was happening with FASA, with Tyco, with WizKids, with FanPro, then Catalyst. But so far, having read all of Dawn of the Jihad and having worked my way through about 80% of Jihad Hotspot's 3070, my opinion of the era has been softening for years as becoming more welcoming to it. But now I'm completely on board. I am down, and I'm going to read all those books. And I think that era for Catalyst is underappreciated and probably actually one of the better eras when we got a lot of products that were really high quality.
This is where we're going to kind of circle back to games we've played, because you telling me about all the stuff you've been finding in the Jihad, even the little pop culture references and that, it was such a throwback to the FASA days to see that, because you really don't see that anymore. But in that, we were going to talk about this, is where we're circling back to a game that we played. I actually ran two Comstar Battle Cobras.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, before we get into that, though, I did want to say that I painted up a Hellbringer that I did heavily modify. It's one of the first times I did a lot of modifications.
It's beautiful.
I know a lot of people have done that before. For me, it was I don't know if I really want to do this. And I was going to paint it for the BattleTech Painting and Customs Facebook group for their yellow competition, and just couldn't get around to it. But I still wanted to get it done. And I remember when I bought that Hellbringer and the Summoner at the same time. It was I think it was the first time that Ironwind Metals used a 3D print of a CAD model to do a master and do a pressing of a miniature off of that. So when Chris Lewis redid all the 3050 Omnis with CAD models, the first couple of them, the Mad Dog, Timberwolf, Warhawk, and Direwolf were all hand-sculpted by Drew Williams. And then for the Summoner and Hellbringer, they did those 3D masters, and I was really excited. I got them off of Battlecore at the time. It was like, okay, cool, you know, Battlecore has them, going to buy them, and they didn't fucking ship for like 6 months, which was just, I mean, that is the Catalyst and FanPro shipping. Like, I'll only get digital stuff from them. Like, I will not buy physical media from them, because it'll never, you'll never get it. You'll never fucking get it. Sorry, yeah. Guys, you just don't. You don't, you're not good at shipping it. But yeah, so I was sitting on those for about, I mean, almost 20 years now. And I still have that Summoner. And I got ideas for the Summoner. But yeah, I was like, okay, I'm going to paint up the Hellbringer. And I painted it up based off of the Hellbringer B from Jeff Laubenstein's CCG artwork. And you guys know from the previous art episode, I love Laubenstein. That dude, or is it Laubenstein? I think it's Laubenstein.
Laubenstein.
Yeah.
Laubenstein.
I love his stuff. He's great. And apparently lives in the Chicagoland area. So.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, yeah. We should hunt him down one of these days. But yeah, his stuff's great. And I just love that stuff. And, you know, Dan's going to probably be putting up some photos. And one of the things I did was, this is one of the first times I really committed to using a complementary color to create a shade tone for the red, yellow, and green. So the idea is that if you take your color, say you take a green and you add a little bit of red to it, you sort of, you desaturate the green into almost like a brownish tone, and you can use that as your shade. Same thing with the red. With yellow, you can add purple to it. You can go from either like a brown, if you're very, very careful, because purple is a super powerful pigment compared to yellow, or to maybe even a puce, or just straight up purple. And it really does look, it looks very cool, and I'm glad I got to experiment that a little bit. Didn't get out in time for the yellow painting competition, only about 6 months late on that one.
Didn't matter, because the man himself liked it.
Yeah, Jeff Laubenstein, Steen, he liked it himself, and that's all that was important.
That's all that matters, yeah. that validation, man. I will say, though, the mix of colors on it was really cool. But I know you kind of beat yourself up over it, but the chipping you did on it was like chef's kiss. Like, yeah. It does look really good.
Thanks,
for
man.
A first attempt.
Yeah, that was one of my first times to really do weathering and chipping. And, you know, for me, one of the big things was, how does stuff, you know, hit the mech? You know, how does it ricochet, especially at corners and edges?
Yeah.
And making that look like there's a chunk of metal that was taken out. Yeah, so... I'm glad you liked it, man. Because yeah, I put a lot of work into it, and yeah, yellow is tough. Yellow's tough, but it was fun.
My goal is to maybe do some. I know when we ordered a couple miniatures, not this run we just got, but the last run you got a Cyclops for me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to do that one after the collectible. One of the pictures for the collectible card game.
Oh yeah.
I'll put it up. I don't remember the artist off the top of my head right now.
Mm.
But yeah, I wanted to try that because I wanted to actually try doing good things with basing and see if I can have it with like the arm on the building.
Oh yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think like I've said it before on the podcast, my biggest strength or my greatest strength is like with modifying and like posing. Mm. So I want to like really push myself with that.
Yeah, a lot of that CCG artwork is really cool, and they did a lot of really, you know, every artist kind of has their way of doing things, and you know they have their style, and they really kind of push themselves in a way beyond what we saw in a lot of the books. I feel like, oh, was that Natty?
That's Natty.
Yeah, it's Dan's through like a cat, the one that I had to amputate the leg. She came into me with a gangrene leg. So
Natasha Perinsky.
Yeah. So I had to amputate it, and now she's fat.
She's really fat. She likes butter. That's what she gets for hanging around with you.
Butter is where it is at. But you know, Dan will probably show a photo of that Cyclops. A lot of that CCG artwork is just, it's really cool stuff. It's definitely kind of a bygone era. I know that Travis over at Renegade HPG has put a lot of work into reviving the CCG,
mm-hmm.
You know, releasing mats and new cards, and it's really cool. It's really cool. Also, Travis is also a big fan of Laubenstein because he's a cool dude and cool people. Good people like Jeff Laubenstein.
I'm just being a fan because I want to fit in.
No pressure. No pressure.
Oh, there's a lot of pressure.
If you don't like it, you're just wrong. That's all.
He's hit me multiple times telling me, be a fan. Yeah. Be a fan.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned Battle Cobras, and we've been talking about battle value, and I will die on this fucking hill. If you think battle value makes the game complicated, I don't know what to tell you, because it is all on the record sheets. All those numbers are on the goddamn record sheets.
It's on the master unit list.
And it's just, it's fucking addition and multiplication. It's just, it's
But they do the math for you. They do it for you.
Like, I'm sorry, man. Was it Bruce? Who was it in the comments?
I don't remember.
I think it's like, man. I mean, I know. I here's the thing too is, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name, but like, and I'm sure, dude. Like, if we were in the same gaming group, we could probably play all day and we get along no sweat, man.
Oh yeah, because we're scenario bros too.
Yeah, and like, you know, using things like campaign ops and doing an ongoing campaign and having a GM who tailors the scenarios in a way that are challenging or just straight up fun is like, yeah, bring it on. Like, not every battle has to be perfectly balanced, and you know, maybe it's just you've got your lance and you're being chipped away at by the opposing force, and it's just that war of attrition. And what can you do to get through it with the least amount of damage? Because you've got to make it to the bigger fight after that. Yeah, totally. Bring it on. Bring it on. But for a stand-up, it's on. The numbers are there. And I just...
It's easy.
It's easy. And I don't think it's that difficult. And I think the resistance to it is just... I don't know.
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't.
Sorry, Matt. Sorry, dude. I know, and I will say, thanks for watching the videos. Thank you for engaging the comments. Thanks for helping out the algorithm.
Hey, go to our Discord.
Yeah, go to...
go like, yell at Adam in our Discord.
Yeah, thanks, man. Like, I do appreciate it. We don't have a big audience. We probably never will. That's totally fine. Thank you, man.
I think this is probably one of the coolest things about our group. It could be annoying sometimes, but... Like, we have so many different play styles, it's insane.
Yeah.
It is just insane.
Oh, with Battletech in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. Battle value is not hard. It's just, I don't see how it's hard. I get, like, how, at first, it's like, okay, how you got to tell your force, you got to use battle value to do this. And, like, what are you talking about? But it's mm-hmm. this is approximating the worth of your unit in a tabletop setting. Here's a multiplier for your piloting skills. Add it up.
Yep. Tech doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Anything, just add it up, have at it.
Yeah. And it's only like, what, 4 or 5 units? You know, it's not like creating like a whole army of like 60 units and, you know, adding stuff up for individual benefits and negatives.
Yes.
I'm looking that up with Chaos Wars, the old Ral Partha game that Ironwind resurrected. That can be a little bit daunting. Like, okay, you've got this many units in a cavalry force, you got this many units in your infantry force. If they all have the same weapon, there's this bonus to them. If they're knights or the yeomen or mm-hmm. they're peasants, this is their multipliers or their negatives. This is how it all adds up. That can be a bit much. You need a whole freaking spreadsheet for that.
Yeah.
But for 4 mechs, no.
There is one thing that battle value can't do, and that's picking the right unit for the battle.
Well, yeah, and certainly, and to an extent, like player skill, and you can do things like handicaps, like, oh, you know, I'll take 20% more than you or whatever. But it's like a fighting game. You could take a mirror match, you know, Street Fighter, you know, Ryu versus Ryu.
Mm-hmm.
The better player is probably going to win. You know, maybe the better player is going to take, you know, 2 out of 10 matches, 3 out of 10, 3 out of 10 or something like that will be lost by that better player. And that's just a matter of skill. You know, it is what it is.
And that's what battle value assumes. Like, it's going to be two skilled players coming together in a mm-hmm. tournament style game to fight. So it assumes that you already know, like, what a Hellbringer B does.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, or like a Summoner Prime.
It is like, I can go to the GameStop the game store and I the shop, and I've got, you know, a four, so we can just pick up and go. But yeah, I mean, if you want to, I mean, I do eventually want to see us play again, like an ongoing campaign, and that's what campaign ops would show up with. But
I feel like we're gonna get to that point.
Yeah. I hope so. We're gonna try and drag some other people along. We got, you know, Peyton's. He's down. He's into it. We haven't scared him away yet.
No, not yet.
Although we've had some good ones. That last match was pretty delicious.
Yeah. And this is what we were getting at.
Yeah. Full disclaimer. Yes, I was an asshole to them. I was a complete dick.
But it was great.
Yeah. And it totally was me being spiteful for the last time we played.
Sorry. Not sorry.
Yeah.
Definitely not sorry. But yeah, that was in this game. It was a what was it? Pursuit.
It was a chase scenario.
Chase, yeah.
So what we did was, based off the scenario options in Total Warfare, there's a couple of different ideas of how these scenarios should play out. And so this one was chase. And so I told the guys, hey, take 6,000 BV. Dan, you take 3. Peyton gets 3. Figured out 2 mechs each.
Questions are asked. Adam, vague answers.
Yes. Or no answers were given. It's like, yes. With the answer of, that's your problem, not mine.
Yeah, and me like, so how many Battle Cobras can I bring?
Yeah.
I really wanted to just try them out.
Well, and one of the nice things about playing more frequently is that you're not so worried about, will XYZ work? Just you know, have at it and see what what does work. And if it does work, okay. We'll put that to the list. You know, this is something to think about in the future.
But the etiquette for building our forces is that was still there, because I was asking, like, hey, is it cool if I try, like, C3I?
Oh, yeah.
Totally, like, I ran it past him, and, you know, I had, like, questions. We'd go back and forth. And obviously, when he built his stuff, like, he followed the rules, too, and didn't.
Yeah. So yeah. With the chase scenario, it assumes that you can either take... So there is the attacker, who in this case is... the runner, the one who's trying to flee to the other side of the map. In this case, there were 3 maps, and we chose those randomly. I think I had you guys roll for it, right?
Did we?
Yeah, I think you guys rolled for it.
I think Peyton might have rolled for it.
And then we just picked them out of the random maps list in Total Warfare.
Oh, I know you did.
Did I?
And I remember you were looking at the map selection. Mm-hmm. And you were rolling for it.
Okay.
And then we set them up the way we wanted them to.
Okay.
Yeah.
We just rolled them in that order. I just laid them out.
Did you?
Did that in the order. But because we took, there were 12 units on the field, 11 or 12 units. We did 3 maps because the game assumes it's about a map per 4 units on the field.
I chose 2 because I wanted to add up, I wanted to have the gunnery and piloting kind of high.
Yeah.
Because I was taking, well, 2 units I wasn't used to. Because I do run Clan Battle Cobras. I love those things. But I really always wanted to try the Comstar ones, you know. Mostly because of C3I. Like, I've always heard good things about it, but I've never actually used it. So I wanted to give... So I took the standard prime variant, which is just 2 large pulse lasers, right? And then I took the MRM variant because I wanted to see, like, well, MRMs suck, but I want to see how they actually work in a C3I environment.
Yeah. And, you know, the with MRMs originally being Draconis Combine tech... and also the Draconis Combine using C3s. I think it that was an era when FASA was trying to develop a specific meta for factions. And so C3s negating some of the negative effects of MRMs, and using that, I think it was an interesting flavor. And so naturally, a C3I being an extension of C3 and using MRMs, it makes sense.
Yeah. So that was me. Peyton chose a Kentaro, just the stock variant. His stuff was all the level 1 stuff, right?
Yeah, 325, sorry. Yeah.
Introductory, that's what it is now.
Yeah.
So he had a Kentaro, a...
Well, he had the Aridney Light Horse Jumping Thunderbolt.
Yes, he had that too.
Yes.
He took the Jumping Thunderbolt.
Not that it saved him.
No, it didn't, unfortunately. And then what else did he take?
No, just the Kentaro, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so then I took a... So the pursuit scenario assumes that the attacker gets, you know, say a lance. Mm-hmm. The defender gets either and or twice the units or twice the battle value. Because the idea is that the attacker has to flee, has to make it to the other end of the map. And I took mostly, you know, kind of fast movers. And a lot of units that I have miniatures for, but I never really had the opportunity to play with. Mm-hmm. So one of which was the Grand Dragon, the 3050 Grand Dragon. Was it the Merrick or the Steiner? I think it was the Steiner Vulcan with mask.
Yes, it was the Steiner one, because he had the Ultra Auto Cannon, too. Yeah.
Ultra Auto Cannon 5s. Ooh, man.
We got a story for that
They shined. They shined. The Cicada with the Ultra Auto Cannon 5. The Davian Upgrade Centurion with the XL Engine, the 6.9 mover. What else did I take? That Dragon. The Dervish.
Blackjack.
Dervish, yeah, the Blackjack, the 3050 Blackjack, the TRO Upgrades Dervish.
Oh, God, that thing was a beast.
Yeah. Oh, I gotta look this up, guys. I apologize. Let me see my photos. What I took. Because I cannot remember anymore. But yeah, I mean, it was definitely pretty good. It was definitely fun. I mean, and using units in a way that was unexpected, mm-hmm. And throwing people for a loop, because being able to throw and move that fast. I mean, I remember seeing Peyton's eyes go fucking wide open now, when he saw that mask.
When I saw a mask, I was like, he's in for it. Yeah. I know, being a Fire Moth fan.
Okay, so Dervish, Centurion, Grand Dragon, Blackjack, Vulcan. Ah, the Enforcer. That was the one.
Yes.
Yes, the 3050 Enforcer with those LBXs. Ah, the Golden DD. The Golden BB that ruined Peyton's leg actuator.
Oh yeah, that's what. Yeah, that didn't help out at all. How are you supposed to retreat off of run across three maps when you could barely freaking move?
Yeah, floating crits.
Admittedly, like, so when we started, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. So like,
I told us, like, hey, this is the pursuit scenario. You got to run.
Yeah, like it. Now, mind you, like, I'm pretty dumb, but, like, I'm not that dumb, usually. But, give me some credit. I don't know. I wasn't thinking. I was tired, whatever. And so, like, it was pursuit. I was moving, so, like, I was trying to, like, move in a way where I could still, like, kind of keep line of sight towards him. But for some reason, I thought he was going to come in, like, at, like, the end phase or whatever.
So those of you that are not familiar.
Yeah.
On the first phase, the attacker enters and can just move. On the second round, the defender or pursuer then is able to enter. So we rolled initiative, and, you know, we just went for it.
Right? And that's where I screwed up, because I don't know. I just wasn't thinking. I had it in my head that something else was going to happen, and then when I actually, like, visually saw it happen, I was like, oh yeah, that was terrible.
Yeah.
We were theoretically, well, we won't talk about the end of the game yet, but I will say, as we were going through, one of the early things that happened was the Golden BB that you alluded to.
Floating crit with the LB-10X.
And it was terrible for Peyton, because it was on his tank.
Yeah,
his freaking tank that was supposed to take the damage. It right to the leg, like, 1 point, and bam, like, what was it, the upper leg or something that took the
hit? I think it was the upper leg actuator. And, of course, you know, what does that mean for jumping movement?
Which he had.
You know, what does that mean for just getting away?
Mm-hmm.
And I it's one of those things, like, in that 3025 era, you know, 4.6 is still pretty useful. But you really do begin to see, like, oh, yeah, you know, 5.8, 6.9, like, yeah, you can really get around a map. You can do a lot of stuff
mm-hmm.
with it. 4.6 ends up getting pretty tough, and then 3.5, like, oh man, like, yeah, it's tough. 3.5 is tough.
And then at that point, you're very quickly, movement is a risk.
Yeah, and like 3.5, like, very quickly, like, you turn, you've got rough terrain. Oh man, I mean, it's you're moving a hex, and it
it was it was interesting to say the least how that played out for it. So, like, what, some of the highlights of that game, the Battle Cobras ended up performing way freaking better than I honestly thought they were going
to. And they were a bit zombie-ish. I mean, especially the
MRM guy, surprisingly.
Well, yeah, I mean, you managed to avoid enough criticals, right? Like, you're going to be fine.
But, that, I mean, that's still part of the game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't assume, like, everything's going to be terrible or, like, great. Yeah. Of how dice treat you, but...
Well, and one of the things, again, you know, thinking about what battle value means and how that factors in the game, it's gotten me into a position where I'm much more willing to take subpar machines just to play with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, taking a Vulcan... That Vulcan has an XL engine, and you know, taking two engine hits and only having single heat sinks. Oh, well, yeah, only having 10 single heat sinks. Well, that's about it.
He's done.
But up until that point, you know, being able to bring an Ultra Autocannon 5 to bear, and granted, I got lucky with that one. I mean, I think out of all the times I fired them, when I did the double tap, only one time did only one shot hit. I think the vast majority of the time, both shots hit. And yeah, I mean, it could be nasty. It makes you think about taking a die Q, the Dreadnought's Combi one from 3050.
Yeah,
you know,
that would be fun to play.
But yeah, you know, it definitely was a different experience. And, you know, usually the Cicada gets a lot of crap, but taking the Cicada and sitting at, you know, a comfortable, like, sort of medium range, getting the TMM up, and just plinking away with the Ultra Autocannon 5 is quite fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was able to... So, like, things obviously got dicey on the first map.
Oh, yeah. They barely...
really bad.
barely got off the first map.
But we were... Because of what actually... It was kind of funny because of what actually happened to the Thunderbolt. It kind of worked in our favor because he was sinking so much damage that we were able to, like, kind of move. Like, he got his Kentaro off onto the second map.
Yeah.
I was able to get my other Battle Cobra with the large pulse lasers, like, start moving him along the map edge, mm-hmm. while the Cicada and the Vulcan were doing their job and they were on his butt.
Yeah. Well, it is funny, like, you know, even though you guys were, in a sense, losing the pressure that was put on you guys. Like, you can just get past that next terrain feature. If you can just get to the next hex, if you mm-hmm. can just survive this round, how that plays out, how that feels. It's definitely something else.
Yeah, the MRM Battle Cobra did die, but, like, If I still have the record sheets, I could probably put them on screen, but dear Lord, they took such a freaking beating.
Mm-hmm.
I think it came down to, on the MRM Cobra, like, he had to get cored, but, like, his legs and, like, everything was just, like, completely demolished. And yeah. I think he ended up taking out two mechs, didn't he? I know the Centurion was one of them.
Yeah, I think he ended up taking the Centurion. I didn't lose that many mechs.
No, you didn't.
It was, I think I lost the Centurion, and I lost the Cicada, basically because the Cicada took a leg hit, an actuator hit, and it ended up actually was a hip.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, the Cicada has such little armor that it can be easily taken apart.
Yeah. So, like, the MRM guy actually ended up taking out, I think he did take out two mechs. MRM's threw their weight, man, and the C3I actually did kind of help it because it was able to keep a short range or medium range modifier at all times.
Yeah.
Because, mind you, like, it's kind of gets, like, reverse snub nose treatment.
Yeah.
Like, it goes 1, 2, 3, and then your medium range starts.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
The large pulse laser guy that I had, same thing, but they were able to play in between that and try and keep short range most of the time.
Yeah.
So once he was gone, we effectively had our other two mechs on the other board. So my large pulse laser Cobra was actually able to cover the Kentaro while it was on retreat.
Yeah, yeah.
And those large pulse lasers, like, everybody gives the Inner Sphere large pulse laser a lot of grief, but in this particular scenario and what we were trying to get out of,
yeah,
like, they did their job.
Well, so, and, you know, to to pick up on what you said a little bit, Inner Sphere pulse lasers are actually great in comparison to other Inner Sphere tech at the time.
Yes.
You know, it's basically you lose your long range entirely, but
you gain in short and medium.
You gain in short and medium. And that can be really beneficial. That on a 2D6, that negative 2 is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so those pulse lasers are definitely worth their weight. And I think in future settings, the small pulse laser as an anti-infantry weapon is fantastic.
It is.
And so, that is something to definitely really think about. It's a shame that they pale in comparison to the Clan pulse lasers. But the Clan pulse lasers are absolutely fucking gross.
The large pulse laser is just terrible. And
that Warhawk with the targeting computer and the pulse. It's just But the Wraith, the 35 Wraith is one of the best specs out there.
Yeah, that's in the Alpha Strike box.
Yeah,
I believe. Yeah, which is sad because in the regular, if they had a City type box with that Wraith in it, it'd work a lot better.
Than
what Alpha Strike can do for it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I mean, in my own humble opinion.
Yeah.
Those pulse lasers, man, they were throwing their weight. 9 points of damage on, Battle Cobra's a medium mech, 40
mm-hmm.
tons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was chasing down mechs of the same weight class. He just moved faster than him.
Yeah.
And he was, I think he was the one that caused the engine crits on the...
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's one of the big things about those Battle Cobras is they have standard engines, right? And
yeah.
So they're very, very zombie-ish. It's on the one hand, it's kind of tough, especially in for the Clans, having those XL engines and being able to move at those increased speeds and carry that much more weapons is important. But at the same time, you look at
they throw out so much damage in that it doesn't matter.
The Battle Cobra, the Kingfisher, they're beasts. They're beasts.
They are. And the Inner Sphere, when they take it, move slower, but it does essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
It really does, and the C3I actually, gives it a different element.
Mm.
Way different element. Yeah. But realistically, though, in that game, the Cobras, I would think, were one of the, high points of that game, because they outperformed my expectations.
Yeah.
But that Vulcan, dude, you have to talk about that Vulcan.
Yeah, that Vulcan is definitely an MVP, right? Just like the Stinger in that one game we had.
Yeah.
Well, when I was younger and, when I understood what taking an XL engine meant, especially for the Inner Sphere, I was like, oh, man, well, I don't want to do that. I mean, it's so risky. I mean, mm-hmm. you're gonna die really fast. But then, I sort of realized that, a lot of times, if you're losing a side torso, you're probably already in a lot of trouble anyway.
Yeah.
And you're being able and willing to experiment and take different machines just for the heck of it has been actually quite a lot of fun, and
it's been really refreshing compared to the experiences I've had in previous games, honestly.
Yeah, well, you see, a lot of people, what they take, and with the whole battle value thing, and people say, well, I want to take my assault lance or my heavy lance, and it's like, I guess, dude, I mean, if you want to just take a bunch of Timberwolves and Marauders, I guess, but I mean, at some point, I think it's more fun to work within the constraints of what you're given. That Vulcan was just causing all sorts of trouble. I mean, it got a bunch of Eternals on a number of different machines. I mean, you just couldn't track the damn thing down until the very end with those large pulse lasers.
That Kentaro was, whiffing a lot of shots at it. It was always in its rear arc.
Yeah, yeah.
Kentaro, it had decent back armor.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it didn't have it that long.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially, I mean, you were, and like you said earlier, I think there was one turn where you actually either missed with it or only hit with one slug.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is compared to how people talk about the Ultra Auto Cannon 5, almost unheard of.
Well, right, right. Well, and again, is a PPC, as long as you have double heat sinks, better than Ultra Auto Cannon 5? Sure. Sure.
Yeah.
But with BV, it doesn't matter. I mean, you're sort of getting a benefit from it because you're taking a weapon that performs fairly well, for far less BV. And you may be able to get a benefit in some other way, either in like gunnery or, you know, being able to put that BV in another unit.
Yeah. I think in most games, other people would have taken that other Vulcan with the large pulse laser. That's the Merrick one.
Yeah. And that would have been great, too. I mean, I did think about taking that one.
Yeah.
But again, it was more battle value. And I would rather would have had maybe more of a balanced force.
But realistically, in Pursuit, I think that one would have been a lot better. Which, obviously, I think that's why it did so good in this scenario. That range helped it.
Initiating that mask.
Mask on top of that, too.
Well, and here's the other thing is, I think that may actually be the first time I have ever used mask.
Wow.
And, you're taking these XL Engine mechs, you're using the 6-9 Centurion, using the Grand Dragon, and being able to sort of, you know, pour on the speed like that. And, even that XL Engine Dragon, I mean, that thing's a beast at 60 tons. It really is. You know, it really, really is.
He took some hits, man. He really took some hits. Yeah. Yeah, like mask was a real nice surprise for our Peyton, our partner in crime now. I think he didn't know about mask, did he?
I don't think he did.
He hasn't used it yet, so he didn't really have an understanding of how it worked. So it might have been in his brain.
I think he has a clan box set, so he has the executioner, so he knows.
He had to know of it, but then like actually seeing it in action, it's like oh, that's what that does. That's not good.
What I thought about doing is, man, wouldn't it be fucking hilarious to take the, so I think it's like XTRO Most Wanted. So back in the mid 2000s and early 2010s, you know, Catalyst was releasing a bunch of these experimental technical readouts, and they were kind of like these really brief ones. They had this one, XTRO Most Wanted, and it's a fireball with, I think, a mask and a supercharger.
Yeah, and like what is it, the double XL?
And the double XL engine, and it's insanely fast. It's hilarious. I would love to just be able to take it one of these days. Like, I'm going to charge you.
I don't even know how you would honestly like get around that. I don't think you can.
Yeah,
it's going to happen. I would be like, okay, we're playing in urban terrain, and I really want to see how far that thing can skid.
Yeah. Man,
it earned the nickname Road Rash.
Speaking of the fireball, you know, man, Nick Jansma over at Sarna, what is he doing with those articles? Like, you know, worst max or whatever, or bad max.
Like some of them, like Nova worst mac, I think was one of them. Come on, man.
He was slagging the fireball. Like, it's just kind of unfair because it's not really taking into account the meta at the time, because it used to be
Streak SRMs used to have Infernos.
Yeah, it was only SRM2s that have Infernos, Streaks or otherwise.
So it was, like it says in its fluff, Elemental Killer.
Yeah.
It did do that.
And then they changed the way Infernos work against Battle Armor, too.
Yeah.
Probably for the better, but it does mean, like... it does make you wonder, like, is there room for... like a fireball variant with, you know, an SRM4, SRM6 with Infernos instead.
Yeah, it's like you would think they would just give Inner Sphere tech, you know, like, hey, you can have an Inferno Streak SRM2 launcher. Like someone just was like drunk one night and was like, hey, what if we take this?
Yeah.
And put it into this.
Yeah.
That'd be great. So it's its own launcher for whatever reason. And we'll put it on a mech. That goes so fast.
Well, I don't know what they were doing, like putting out like those one-shot launchers on stuff. I don't know what the hell they were thinking.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's
Before I forget about the Vulcan, I think part of my thought process about how that was the perfect pick for that scenario was also because of how long the maps were, how long we had it.
Yeah.
The reach on that Ultra Auto Cannon 5 was really damn good.
Yeah.
So you were almost always taking a shot from it.
Which is pretty great.
Which is an advantage over the large pulse laser one, because it didn't have mask. I don't think that one has mask.
No, it doesn't. I think also being aware of the fact that there are different situations where you may run out of ammunition. I think, you know, for example, the Timberwolf Prime, where it only has one ton of LRM ammo for each launcher.
Yeah.
You're going to run out of ammo with that one. So you do kind of have to be a little bit careful. But being... willing to take shots that maybe aren't the best dice rolls because those ammunition weapons are heat efficient, and you might as well spend that ammo because it's just waiting to blow up in your chest anyway.
I'm getting on a soapbox on this a little bit. Everyone says, like, oh, the Clan Prime variants, they're so bad. Do you really need... You have the ability to go, you know what? I think I'm just going to fire an LRM-20 this round. Mm. You know, like, on a machine that has two of them.
Yeah.
And, like, all these other damn weapons with it. And what were your targets back then? Like, a freaking Stinger? Who has to, like, fire everything to do, like, some kind of damage?
Well, yeah. considering that you want to see max that can do 20 points minimum, like, that's such an important number to force a opponent's skill roll.
It's like the Direwolf, you know? It's like, oh, it doesn't have enough heat sinks to fire, or, like, the Prime variant, it doesn't have enough heat sinks to fire everything. It's like, you could fire one whole arm! Like, what are you complaining about? That one whole arm has the same firepower as something, like, in its weight class in the Inner Sphere. What are you complaining about?
Well, you know, it's like the Stalker.
Yeah.
You know, learning how to you know, bracket weapons to be most effective, and that's really important.
Yeah, I got a Stalker in one arm, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wah, wah. Clan variants are bad, but anyway.
Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, Clan players.
I felt dirty in that tank game.
Yeah.
But anywho.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, to get back, yeah, using mechs you wouldn't normally use, and being able to do that in different scenarios actually was really cool. It was really cool. And I'm excited to look into sort of the Chaos campaign, as outlined in Campaign Ops. So Campaign Ops has a couple different ways, Campaign Operations, I should say. There's a couple different ways to create forces. And there's some really neat options about, you know, using your reputation. And it's given me thought about sort of mixing and matching different things to make it work out. But using the Chaos Campaign system and the War Chest to keep track of things is something that I definitely want to look into for ongoing campaigns.
I'd like to see how it would adapt to what we have going on right now.
Well, I think it's... If we were to do, like, okay, hey, you know, what if we do, like, linked scenarios and use campaign ops to...
I feel like we would do, like, you build a force, you know, here's the battle value, you build a force, and each scenario, like they have in there, just pick whatever from that force, and you're running it that game.
Right, you know? Right. Well, it's sort
so,
of
like, we would know what we have in forces beforehand.
Yeah,
but
it's really the idea of, like, using, like 30% of your total force or something like that. What I think is really neat is some of the different things that you can add on in a way that can maybe boost your war chest. Like, oh, I'm going to use the light fog option, or the rain, or night combat. I also think, like, keeping track of searchlights is cool, and using that, like, what mechs have searchlights. Although I probably would change, or would house rule that, you know, a lot of these designs, it's pretty obvious which one has a searchlight and where it's located, which torso it is. And so in the rules in Tac Ops, if you can find the right page, depending on what edition you've got, if you take any torso damage, I think it's on a 7 or more, you roll again in a 7 or more, that searchlight gets broken. I think I would use it more where, depending on the mech, like, which torso gets hit, you know, do you roll? For example, the Hellbringer and the Warhammer, you'll have that big searchlight on top of the left torso. I would say, okay, if you hit the left torso, then you roll, rather than any torso location.
Yeah, that'd be a lot better. That's fair.
Yeah, and I probably would change some things. I think, depends on the artwork. And it's not like that on the new classic version of the Shadowhawk, but the original Doug Ram version, I think it had headlights, if you get my drift.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
Yeah. So I would probably include that. You know, make sure those mechs have searchlights. So I think using that and those rules go back, I think, to the original, you know, Great of Legion scenario book. there's a scenario that has night combat, and it lists which ones have searchlights. I think that's the first time I saw that mentioned. Unless it was in BattleMech Manual. Or sorry, the BattleTech Manual.
It might have been. I vaguely remember seeing that kind of stuff in the old scenario books. Some instances. It's kind of cool how Chaos Campaign kind of came full circle and turned into like an abstract version of the old scenario books. And it's not as interesting, you know, well, obviously.
One of the things that I we should probably start including like chapters, you know, for the YouTube videos is, oh, they're talking about scenario books now.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why a lot of these old scenario books stopped being made the way they were is because people didn't want to play sort of the way everything was listed out, like in the scenario. And I think being able to take your own force was something that really appealed to a lot of people. Like, okay, you know, I can make a force that fits the faction I'm using, but I want it to be my own. And I think being able to do that is cool. Although I think it is, you know, I think it is important that you want to try to achieve a feel. You know, and seeing all these assault mechs in Aridney Light Horse colors is really weird.
Yeah, it is.
Is it the Mercenaries Handbook, the first one that has like the full TO and E of like Waco's Rangers and the Aridney Light Horse in there?
Yes.
And I think it even has Wilson's Hussars.
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, apparently it's actually pronounced Hussars. I did not know that.
Is it really?
I think it's Hussars. Because I think it's Polish.
Well, I'm a bad Polish.
Yeah. Bad Polak. Really bad. Yeah. So Wilson's Hussars. I think it has those. Because I know a couple of those old scenario books and old source books, you know, had full TO and E's, which was way too excessive. And I'm glad that they stopped doing that. Because it's a bit much. But, you know, the Wolf's Dragoons, the Jade Falcon source book, possibly the Wolf source book, the Mercenaries Handbook, a lot of them having full TO. And it's just like, man, did you guys really need to pay somebody to spend all that money to do a full regiment?
A lot of them don't age well, too.
Yeah.
You really don't.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Ow. But yeah,
did the microphone pick up that crack?
Probably.
Damn. Good microphones.
I know, you went all out on him, man. Yeah. But yeah, the last scenario was pretty good, and it would be really interesting to see chaos, like doing like an actual chaos campaign and being able to, like you said, use fog. I didn't even consider that, honestly. I totally forgot you can do that.
Yeah.
Spend points to do that. I mean, you can even do like points to get reinforcements too, couldn't you?
Yeah, and it depends on what the scenario allows or what options you take. Yeah. So a lot of the options, I think, are intended to make the player versus the GM, to make the player's job harder so that they get a bigger payout at the end.
Yeah.
And there are a couple different ideas in campaign ops that you can use. I'd like to see actually applied. And, you know, part of it, you know, it makes sense in a tactical level and what you get from history. Like, okay, if I attack this depot, I'm going to affect or hamper the opposing forces' operations for the rest of the campaign. So one of the big ones was, you've got a couple of different options, and maybe one of them is, okay, if I attack the airfield, I'm not going to get strafed anymore by aerospace fighters.
Yeah.
Cool. If I attack the fuel depot, all the vehicles that use internal combustion engines can no longer use flank speed. They all have to go at cruising, which is huge, right? So stuff like that is interesting. Hit the ammunition depot, you know, maybe half reloads or something. Or maybe there's a finite amount that the GM has to keep track of. Stuff like that, I think, is pretty cool. On the one hand, I think someone at the boards called it accountant tech, which I think is pretty cool. In a way, if you're willing to take care of that many numbers in your head or on a sheet of paper, but like, okay, I got X amount of reloads for my LRM launchers. I can only use that amount, and you know, that's all there is to it. And if I go beyond it, then I have to start, you know, not taking full LRM reloads, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely cool. It's cool things to think about and consider. And then to feed that back into campaign ops and to create an ongoing campaign. Because when we were playing previously with the group, you know, we were kind of doing that with Alpha Strike. But, I mean, Alpha Strike was just so...
It was too abstract.
Yeah, too abstract, too simplistic. It was just missing something. Yeah.
But we're back in Classic, and it's feeling good.
Yeah.
Rolling all those cluster hits, and...
Yeah.
It's good.
Those cluster hits are nasty.
They really are. I mean,
people are like, oh, cluster table, ah, it's so much work, so many die rolls. Nah. But no, I mean, it it can ruin your day.
Yep.
Yeah.
Poor Thunderbolt.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, somebody on the boards had mentioned, like, do you guys play with, you know, a two as, you know, how it is in the rules, or do you guys do floating crits? And I think floating crits is far more fun. Yeah. It's both, like, less lethal, but also more lethal.
Yeah, floating criticals, I think, has kind of become... I'm surprised it's not actually turned into, like... I mean, it is an official rule, but it's more like an official house rule.
Yeah.
So it's like, as long as both sides agree on it, you use it. And almost every single game I played after using it, like, I haven't... Or since the first time I've used it.
Yeah.
Never gone back.
Yeah.
You know, I think we maybe done a handful of games where we went back, but it's still Battletech, but it's like, nah, I don't know, man. Floating crits adds like a whole different element.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, it certainly taking like a gyro hit or an engine hit is pretty serious. And it's not something that to be ignored and definitely has its own benefit. But I think floating crits in general is pretty fantastic. I mean, it happened to me twice, or I've been in a game twice where it's happened where it was a floating crit head cockpit shot. But you know, to be like, okay, like a leg actuator or an ammunition explosion or like a main gun taken out, like yeah, it's definitely something else. Yeah,
I like it. I like that a lot. If I can say, if anyone wants to use a house rule, that is the one to use. 100%.
Yeah, floating crits definitely is where I think it's where it's at. It's definitely a lot more interesting.
It's kind of weird because it makes battle mechs feel a little more like vehicles in a way, because like vehicles take hits in different spots, and you know their criticals affect different.
Well, and the idea that there's maybe an imperfection in the armor, and of course you know it's not just always center torso. If you shoot from the right side, it's you know possible floating or possible crit on the right torso or the left torso respectively.
It's an extra dice roll, but it's an extra dice roll that like accomplishes something that's like worth doing.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, just like cluster hits. Like I don't care. Like our experience with them lately.
Yeah,
worth rolling all of that up. It's worth using the cluster table.
Yeah, one of the things I thought about, and I almost don't want to mess with it in a way because it's just like you know this is the way it is, and you know it works out fine. But you know possibly doing what we did when we did our own like. Homebrew set of rules where we were experimenting with that with the hit location tables where from the left side the right torso location is actually left torso rear.
Yeah. That did add a really interesting dynamic too.
Yeah.
Cause you had the well we also changed movement in that, but besides the point, even if the movement was back like you know, the way it should be, the rear arc becomes way more important. And then like because most people when they play the game they gravitate towards like either the front arc or the rear arc. You very rarely see people try and get into like the right arm or like left arm arc. At least like more typical players, like more veterans like you and me, like we realize okay, Centurion doesn't have anything in the left arm, so I'm gonna go over there.
Yeah,
but when you actually make it where you have a chance to actually hit a rear location, that makes a pretty big difference, and it makes covering your arcs a lot. It really changes dancing around like arcs in the game like different.
Yeah,
you know, like all of a sudden your faster mechs like a Fire Moth and that kind of have a little more utility in the game. You know, because before. You know, like, if you have, like, a Vulture Prime and a Fire Moth Prime, or Mad Dog Prime, Fire Moth Prime, you know, playing together, you almost always have to get in the rear arc, you know? You're going to eat a Pulse Laser no matter what, but you have to get in that rear arc to fire.
Yeah.
But if you can't get there now, you at least have a chance if you're in the left or the right arc, you know? So I feel like for smaller, like, lighter designs that move, it does create a different, it does expand on it a lot more and make the game a little more favored for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I, that would be something I'd be interested in experimenting with again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
trying out again. I think that was one of the other rules we had a lot of fun with next to the autocannon one, which was in our pilot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, maybe we'll talk to Peyton about it, see if he's comfortable with doing that or just wanting to keep it as is. Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, I know some more advanced players, especially on the fora, will talk about using firing arcs and being much more conscientious of, like, what that means and trying to consistently hit the same arc over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, being able to sneak in a rear torso hit, it definitely changes the meta quite a bit. Unless you're in an awesome, which has a huge amount of rear torso armor.
Yeah. Well, then again, it makes more sense why he would carry, or she, however you want to refer to your mech as, would carry that much armor in the back. Because if you're able to get in the, you know, left and right arcs like that, you're almost certainly going to take some kind of hit back there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the awesome, yeah, you know, it makes it a little less durable because it's going to take more damage back there, but it's still a freaking awesome.
Yeah, it's a zombie.
It was designed for that.
Complete zombie.
Your Thunderbolt, same thing.
Yeah.
You know, but then Max, like, the Stormcrow and that, like, they gain more of an advantage because they're kind of built the same way.
Yeah.
You know, because the Stormcrow has a crap ton of back armor.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, like, this recent game really flipped a lot of things I would normally do on its head. Even since we're talking about arcs, there were a lot of times where, because I had no choice to really scoot my Battlecrobra, like, on the edge of the map, like, on the side, you know.
Mm.
But you were constantly, because you were in its, like, right arc, always kicking the leg. Didn't matter. It was always the same leg. Like,
yeah.
It's another place where a lot of people take, don't worry about arcs, you know.
Yeah.
Even in it, like, in that game, too, I found myself, maybe not, like, in this game in particular, but, like, in other games. Like, I typically take fast mechs, but I kind of find myself walking a little more often, you know, because we have to kind of watch our battle value and that, so your gunnery is going to stay kind of high.
Yeah.
And a lot of people forget, like, you know, you don't have to run constantly.
Yeah.
You can walk sometimes.
Yeah, you know, when I was younger, it was always, you know, the biggest, baddest max. And I remember looking at my collection and a couple of years ago and being like, wow, you know, this is really skewed.
Top heavy.
Yeah, top heavy. And of course, you know, one of the first books I ever got my hands on was a secondhand copy of Wolf's Dragoons and, like, Zeta Battalion. And, like, oh, yeah, look how awesome Zeta Battalion is. But the reality is that, you know, on an actual playing field in an actual game, it can be tough, and even though you've got you know, an assault machine, it may not really work out for you the same way, and it does make you think of, you know, those mechs that have, you know, rear firing weapons, the Dragon, the Quick Draw, the Archer, the Battle Master, the Atlas. I'm pretty sure I'm missing
there's a lot more.
But being able to
Ostrock.
The Ostrock, yep. And the Ostsoul, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So being able to have rear firing weapons definitely has its own benefits. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So cool.
So yeah. Pretty much, I mean, we're learning a lot of battle value. And I know we bring up battle value a lot, but I mean, hey, we've been playing a lot more games with it and really don't know what people are complaining about. Yeah. But I mean, we also don't, I mean, in this case, you kind of played like a jerk, wink. But it was, I was due to get punished. I was due to take the beating.
On the audio version of this episode, you are not seeing my head nod vigorously along to this.
But no, it was good. And, you know, we're looking forward to getting in more games. We're trying for once a month.
Yeah, yeah. If things work out consistently and regularly, and maybe if we can find some more people to join us, I would like to think about, you know, what does a campaign look like, and, you know, what would it mean if it could be, you know, people that can get together and you guys could form a lance, you know, whether that's three or four of you guys, that, you know, and then I like being the GM. you know, I like doing that. I like crafting the stories and creating the scenarios and kind of coming up with some interesting situations that mm-hmm. put you guys for a loop. And it would be good to see that happen. I think at that point, for me, you know, battle value comes into play where it's what can be, like I said earlier in this episode, what can be a situation that stresses you out, but maybe is not going to be one that you would lose. But what does it mean if you lose X amount of armor? What does it mean mm-hmm. if you have to fire this many shots? And what does that mean for the next fight or the one after that in between, you know, an RPG element where you have to kind of act something out and kind of, do you find the ammunition you need? You know, what happens to your support staff? Do you have the time between battles to rearm? You know, what does that actually look like? And how does that play through? So yeah, okay, maybe you fought, you know, two lances of light tanks that pretty much crumbled before you.
Yeah.
But you took that many autocannon 5 hits from scorpions or something, and now you're in trouble. Yeah. Stuff like that.
Thank you, Quixel.
for that reason, I'm gonna use Vedits now.
But cool. This episode, it was more. I know it wasn't really like a specific kind of format, but we really wanted to get something out there and talk to you guys.
Well, we wanted to follow up and just say, hey, you know, this is what's going on. This is what we're doing. It'd be nice to plan some stuff out and do those series we've been talking about. I've given thought to maybe doing some solo reviews. I know you've done some solo painting stuff and other things. Mm-hmm. I'd like to. To kind of chip away at some of the things that I've been wanting to get to that I know you haven't had time to read yet. We'll see. But again, hey, being an adult, right? I don't know how Tuck does it. How does Tuck deal with so many episodes?
I don't know. All that travel and...
Does he have a job?
Tuck, do you have a job?
Are you unemployed?
Oh, man. Yeah, he... I can speak from experience driving like that. I have not driven the same distance that poor fellow has, you know, but my God, does it drain you?
Does it
drain you? The last time I had to travel, I had to go to St. Paul, Minnesota on like a whim. I was driving to Kankakee, Illinois, mm-hmm. and I had to turn right back around.
Oh yeah. You told me that.
Pack my stuff and freaking go.
Yeah.
And the next day I think this was the time when my wife was dealing with a lot of her health issues, which is part of the reason why I left the other job. But anyway, I had to come back the next day. So I drove out there, did what I had to do, and drove back.
Mm.
St. Paul, Minnesota, back to Joliet, Illinois, like in one day.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's tiring. And I can imagine like being talking like, He has like maps drawn out, you know, like the stuff that he does. Just like, I get it, dude.
Yeah, I get it.
It's tough.
Yeah, he's got some cool stuff that he's done. I need to watch more of his videos. I mean, I'm not on the Patreon, so I can't.
His Halloween stuff is really good.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna, this is the month to really watch Battlebound.
Although I know, you know, he's a big wrestling dude. I don't give a fuck about wrestling. I know.
I get bond with him on that.
Yeah, I know you dig it, man. I just like oh, whatever, man. But yeah, I mean, Tuck is definitely a very positive force. Oh, you know what? Damn it! That's what I was supposed to do. Did you get the patch from Carrie?
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, also to close the episode, we should have done this at the beginning, but a big thank you to Carrie from Unicorn Company for the patch. Dan and I each got a patch for participating in the Travis project, the Travis charity project for LGBTQ youth. We were able to paint up a miniature or two and get it for the NovaCat C Company or C Galaxy. I think it's in Greek, it'd be pronounced Kasi, but I think everyone just says Zai or whatever. Z.
Yeah. Guilty.
We were happy to participate and we were happy to help out. I know we raised a lot of money for it and that was really cool. And really thankful for Carrie for setting out the patch.
Yeah, this is super cool.
It's super gay and we totally dig it.
Yep.
Yeah.
I love it, man.
It's so gay. And
I love it.
We're there for you, Carrie.
Thank you.
We're excited for next year because we'll definitely be on board and hopefully we'll be podcasting more regularly. Maybe. But we'll make sure to do a shout out before the raffle happens.
Yeah.
So yeah. But cool. Well, hey guys, take care. Thanks for listening to this ramble. Thanks for listening to us talk about our last battle. And yeah, we will see you next time.
On the flip side.